commitment, blood, sweat, and tears. Do whatever it takes to get what you need. I mean, I'm 5'8", so when I say I play basketball, they laugh. You gotta be like 7 foot tall. So like, just commitment and hard work. If you want to get somewhere, you've got to work harder and you've got to be persistent and you've got to eat, breathe, and shit.
Okay, I know what you're thinking. You're thinking, Josh, you're on that bullshit, bringing these dubstep guys around. Or maybe you're thinking, what is dubstep? Or maybe you're thinking, Josh, you're on that bullshit. At least you brought these dubstep guys around. Basically, what I'm trying to say is I have no idea what you're thinking. But our guests today are Casper and Rusko, pioneers of dubstep before it blew up and became the big festival thing that you hear today. These guys were doing it. They came together in 2009 for a mix CD called Fabric Live Volume 37 that was kind of a game changer and really put dubstep on the map globally after it was kind of coming out of London. So they took a bunch of time off, or I should say they've been doing their own thing separately and have now come back together after a while. And in our interview, we're going to dig into what they've been up to and what it takes to make a partnership like that work, and you know, how you stay in the game. If you're not a dubstep head, you'll understand that music really changes really quickly. And so to have longevity in that genre takes some special attention. So we'll get into the interview after this, our EDM.com track of the week.
Off your blowers, girl.
Yeah, we're back with Rebel Radio. That was our EDM.com track of the week. This one was from the guests themselves, Casper and Rusko, a new track called Blouse and Skirt, a banger if you're into that kind of thing. And Rebel Radio is available on iTunes, SoundCloud, Stitcher, TuneIn, on Dash Radio, our new time slot starting next week, Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Pacific. Don't miss it live. And you can always find us on social media on our new Facebook page or on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. And now let's get into the interview with Casper and Rusko. But first of all, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you guys here.
Yeah, no.
I've been a fan of what you're doing since Fabric Live. And I'm especially excited because, you know, I think the British accents are going to make us all sound a lot smarter, which is great.
Ladies love it.
I'm sure they do.
Ladies love it.
I'm sure. So you can talk in your regular accent if you want to let that go.
Yeah, right.
Is that put on then? Just kidding.
Yeah. The British accent is totally, that's like fake. I have a Valley Girl accent.
Nice.
And in real life, yeah.
Love it. Besides, you got the show tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Everything. Nice.
Yeah.
Everything, got a press. Anything. Yeah, no, we just, yeah, I think doing a bit of press and he's sorting out a bit of, because he still lives here, kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I've
okay.
got my whole of my house to sort out and move.
You're moving out?
Yeah. I'm in the process of moving back to England.
So okay.
Yeah, I've got that all that thing? To take care of.
Why are you moving?
Oh, it's the weather. Yeah, I miss the rain.
Sure.
I don't. No, yeah, time to move back to get the old, just get the UK vibes back.
Okay.
Yeah.
I miss the UK vibes.
How does that change your creativity living
oh loads
place like this? Yeah,
loads. Yeah.
How so?
I don't know. I suppose like the music that I'm personally most fond of was done mainly when I was back living in the UK.
Yeah.
So sort of being back in the UK brings the same sort of vibes, and I'm sort of trying to channel and that same kind of feeling that I was getting back.
Yeah.
Sort of 7-8 years ago before I moved, which is when I wrote a lot of the classic tracks that a lot of people like.
Sure.
And I still have a lot of fondness for. So trying to kind of capture the same vibe.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because, you know, I think that's one of the things that we're discovering in this show is that, you know, your music is an output of what you're experiencing at a certain time.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, as life changes and, you know, especially when you're first starting out, right, you're kind of doing your thing and next thing you know, you're on planes and, you know, backstage and surrounded by who knows what. It, like, it's just a totally different scenario, right?
Yeah, totally.
And that has to have an effect on your music.
You don't write music.
Yeah, right. Yeah, sure.
Because you're doing everything but what you want to do.
Right. Yeah, definitely.
But you are doing what you want, but you're not. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure.
You start out doing what you want, and then you end up doing stuff, and you're like, oh, yeah, I've made my goal where I want to be DJing all over the world. And you're like, actually, I don't like it. I want to go back to my bedroom and just write music. Because when I'm out here, the old saying, more money, more problems, it is.
Right. Yeah.
It's just, you know. It's just the balance.
Yeah.
It's trying to get the balance. Less is more.
Sure.
And without the music, because you know what people do, they write music for so long, then they blow up, and then they tour like crazy for like 3-4 years. Mm-hmm. And in that time, they write no music, and they throw out a few remixes. And then you come back, and there's not been no music out, there's no shows come in. So it's like, you've got to get that balance right of saying no to stuff to keep the music flowing. Because without the music, it doesn't. Nothing means nothing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So just getting that really, that balance. And I think that's what's good this time around with us. We're kind of, we've done so much. I think we know where to keep the weight balanced.
Yeah. You know, you guys connected, you had Fabric Live, I think, was an important record at the time for what was happening with dubstep. It was really sort of, you know, emerging as a genre.
Yeah.
And, you know, you guys had a big hit and that became part of it. And now the genre has seen loads of changes.
Yeah, definitely.
In that time.
Yeah.
And you guys have had your own path within that. And now you're back together. So I want to talk a little bit about, you know, what did you learn along the way and what's brought you back together now?
Well, a good coincidence is that without knowing it, I took, you know, the best part of this year off, you know, no gigs, just took some time off and decided to go back to England and see my family and friends back there and stuff. And Casper at the same time took a load of time off from gigs. And the idea was that we both, you know, get off the road for a while and write some music and just kind of go back to basics. So it was just a happy coincidence. Yeah, without even knowing it, we both decided to do that. And I decided to go back to the UK to spend my time off there. And yeah, we just decided, we just little text to each other was, hey, should we get in the studio and see if we can still do a track, you know, just let's hang out for a day and just hang out and smoke and see if we can make a tune again kind of thing. And that turned into 2 days and two tracks, which turned into another 2 days the next week. And that kind of spiraled out of control. And my month-long visit to the UK to see family and friends and make a tune with Casper turned into moving house permanently to the UK, making a whole album and booking a show and all the rest of it. So
yeah,
that's from my side, kind of.
It was
how it all went.
It was nice because it was just
natural.
You know, like the best things are always organic,
mm-hmm.
and when you force stuff, it sometimes kind of bites you in the ass, or it translates. People are not stupid. Yeah. They know when they're being sold something and it's fake. But sometimes they're all right with it and they do it. But in this occasion, it was so natural and so organic. And we just went in the studio and we haven't been in the studio together for, I'd say, 7-8 years.
Mm.
We haven't, stood next to each other in a studio. And then it was like we'd never left. It was like 8 years ago.
Nice.
You know, back in West London. And I think when you've got a chemistry like that with someone, it's very unique and very special.
Yeah.
And so we was like, let's not do all the stuff that we hate for a long time. Mm-hmm. Let's just write music and have so much fun. And that's all we're doing.
That's great.
And that's why it was like, do you want to do a tour? We was like, no, don't want to do a tour.
Yeah.
We just want to write music and we want to do a show and we want to celebrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And then if stuff happens afterwards, then it happens. If it doesn't, it doesn't. We're cool with that.
Yeah.
And because we went it with that kind of mentality, I think it's translating.
Mm.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the show is kind of a message like, hey, we're back and we've got a ton of new music. You know, that's kind of, it's just sort of letting people know that we're back.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can follow that one big show with all the music before we, you know, come back again and do more shows or whatever follows that.
Yeah.
So how does it feel different now to when you guys were starting out together?
Doesn't. That's the fun thing. It feels exactly the same.
Okay.
It feels like it was when we first started out.
Mm.
Like, oh, we wanna be DJing. We want people to hear our music. We want people to know who we are. It's the same again.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like, the generation has shifted, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're just appealing to people who know who we are. And maybe a younger audience who will check out and go, oh, that's pretty cool. Oh, what else have they done? Maybe they pick up the Fabric CD because maybe when it came out, it was only 10 years old.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So
that's the best thing about, you know, in the gap of 7-8 years between, you know, that's how long it's been since we made tracks. We didn't get together and try and do it at all during that time. That's the good thing about it. It's kind of like, we can recapture the vibe that we had before because we didn't kind of try and dirty it or do anything. It's kind of, we've kind of preserved the memory of how it was before, and we've come back to it so long after the initial event that we can sort of capture the vibe and go right back into it. And we're still having the weekly studio sessions, still making tracks, you know, so
nice.
As long as that's going on, then that's the best thing, really, because that's the most fun and that's what we both love doing the most.
Yeah, and early on, I think it's just the excitement and the buzz.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all we want to do. Like, it's super selfish, but we've done so much in the last 8 years. Like, I'm not, and I think Chris is not, we're not trying to prove anything.
Mm-hmm.
We've proved we can show you the list and the Discog and what we've done and the tours and where we've played and who we've played next to. We're not trying to prove anything. We're just having fun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we're hoping it translates. That's all it is.
Mm.
So it feels exactly the same, to answer your question, which is great.
Nice.
Yeah. It's like splitting up with your ex and then getting back with her, and it's exactly the same.
Yeah.
Which is strange.
Steady on.
But no, we saved it. We saved it to the... We could have rinsed it, and we could have done the tours in between our tours. And at one point, I did think, oh, we've missed out on an opportunity because dubstep's really popping and we're not going to do this.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it was nothing before its time. And I think if we'd have done it, it wouldn't have been a special now.
So why did you guys stop?
We're just too busy.
Yeah.
This is the thing that people have to remember. We're not a duo. We're individual artists.
Mm-hmm.
We just come together
because
we were like-minded. We were writing similar style tunes, a similar vision. And we was DJing together. If you look at our catalogue, we've probably made 10 tunes together.
Mm-hmm.
That's not really a duo.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And we come together for the Fabric CD because we was writing music together and we was playing the same sort of stuff.
And the Fabric CD is pretty much all individual tracks as well.
And it's all individual tracks. Yeah, there's hardly any collabs on there.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's kind of like two individual artists that blew up together and we was like, oh, great. But now we're going to carry on on our paths. And,
and then, of course, like pretty soon after that I moved out to LA, so geographically it makes it quite hard to work together, you know.
Yeah.
5,000 miles.
Sure. Well, take us back to the beginning a little bit. I'm curious to know how you guys got started. What was the what was your introduction to music and kind of how'd you know that this was your path?
How did we, us two together or individually?
Well, individually.
That back music background.
Oh, okay.
So I know you studied music, right,
Chris? Yes. Yeah. Well, kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's alleged that I studied music.
Okay.
I spent 2 months at the music college before I left, and they spent the next, like, 5 years publicizing how I was like their star student. They put me in all their literature and everything. So I had them take me out. But yeah, it's like everywhere that I studied music.
Yeah.
No, I left school at 16.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't study music. But yeah, I kind of did.
And you
on
left
my
school
own.
To be a DJ?
I left school, yeah, just to play music. You know, I was playing in bands, and I was playing saxophone and bass guitar, and I played in a reggae ska band and all kinds of stuff like that. So yeah, I left school to do music. Yeah,
nice.
Yeah, pretty much. But yeah, the whole music school thing has followed me around everywhere. Crazy, crazy.
It's you know, Wikipedia tells us.
I know, it's nuts. It's nuts. But yes, no, but yeah, I was pretty much spending the whole time just, you know, learning new instruments and.
But you always knew you wanted to be a musician.
Yeah, that's all I ever did. Yeah, that's why I didn't really get on with the whole school system. Per se.
And then when did it start to feel like a career?
I guess after I linked up with Casper, who was running just set up Dub Police, a label, and I guess when we put the first vinyl out, really, when we put the first vinyl release out, three tracks on a 12-inch vinyl that was, you know, available all around Europe, and that was. That was probably the moment. Yeah, that was the moment when I decided to move down to London.
Yeah.
To, you know, live near Casper and live where all the clubs and all the dubstep nights were happening. So that vinyl being released for me was kind of the catalyst for me moving out from my place way up in the sticks down to London. And that was sort of the, okay, yeah, this is it now. So that's kind of when I quit the day job, so to speak.
Yeah.
And so do you remember a moment, so you had the label and, you know, you're making sort of records pretty early in the dubstep world.
I was just DJing.
Yeah.
Because I don't play any instruments. I'm not musical at all.
Yeah.
As far as that goes. I've just learned and just by practicing and knowing what sounds good and knowing how to press a few buttons. It's kind of how I get my sound.
How'd you learn to DJ? Somebody teach you?
No. I mean, music's always kind of been in my household. I've got two brothers, and they're both record collectors. My dad's a record collector. My dad's into, like, hugely into punk.
Mm.
And my older brother was, like, solely the guy that got me into hip-hop, because he was way into hip-hop, you know, like, got me into Mobb Deep, Wu-Tang, Talib Kweli, all the Raucous Records kind of stuff, Gangsta. That was kind of, like, through going into his room and stealing his records. And then my little brother was into, like, in like 60s bands and kind of stuff.
Mm.
So we've got music, love and passion in the household, but no one plays instruments apart from my little brother.
And what was do you remember the first record that really like had an impact on you?
Yeah, I remember like as a kid, because the thing is, like I was saying this yesterday to someone, that in the UK, especially in London, we didn't go out of our way to listen to dance music. It was in our blood.
Yeah.
Like, jungle and hardcore and UK garage and that was just standard. You standardly listen to that.
What's on the radio?
Yeah, it's on the radio. It's on pirate radio. It's everywhere. It's like that's just what you grow up on.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, I just wanted to just DJ and buy a few records in the bedroom. But going back, I remember my first real introduction to dance music for myself was there was a tune by Snap called "Rhythm Is a Dancer."
Yeah,
and I bought that on tape cassette.
Nice.
And I heard that and it just blew my mind. I was like, wow, what is this? Rhythm is a dancer, it's a soul's companion. You can feel it everywhere. Lift your hands and voices, free your mind and genres. You can feel it in the air. Oh, it's so passion. Oh, you can feel it in the air.
How do you then?
How was I then? That come out in. Showing my age, I think I was 10, maybe younger, when that come out.
Yeah.
And I bought it on cassette. And yeah, that for me was like, I knew of like hardcore and jungle, but actually owning a bit of music, that was my first bit of music that I went out and bought and purchased. So yeah, and I used to play basketball. That's my background.
Yeah.
And I had a scholarship to a school in Maryland. I played for England, but I dislocated my shoulder like way too many times, and they was kind of like, you're not gonna, this is the prime of your career, you're not gonna play for a long time.
Yeah.
So I didn't go to America. I ended up not playing for England and going to the tournament, So music was always in my background, and so I kind of went out and bought a few records and just wanted to just DJ in the bedroom and that. And it went from that into like, oh, I wonder if I could make what I've got in my head, and then finding out about kind of like when UK garage is really dark, it started getting very dark and forward thinking. I was like, oh, what's, I like that kind of sound. Yeah. How do I make that? And that's kind of how I really fast forwarded into, let me just try and mess around. And
was there a garage record that really like caught you?
Yeah, there was a record when garage was all like girly, champagne, bubbly kind of style. There was a record called Safe Soul, and it was by a guy called DJ Narrows.
Mm.
And it was
good tune.
That come out, and it is so dark. When you listen to it now, it's not that dark, but at the time it was so dark, and it was so bubbly still. It still had that garage skank. That changed it for me. I was like, what is this?
You know the music that didn't save my life. If it wasn't for the music, I don't know what we'd do.
This is what I like. I like this dark side of it. And that was really the really, really early stages of kind of...
It's very drum and bass sounds, wasn't it?
Very drum and bass sounds, yeah. But like sort of...
Well, the garage tempo.
Garage, dubstepy tempo. And then it's kind of... Everything for me spiraled from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing that stood out to me, you know, I went back this week and was listening to some of your guys' music. And there's a lot of that darkness. There's a lot of dub. Right in there, and it's certainly not, you know, it's funny because it kind of been a while, and it wasn't what I think of as dubstep today.
Yeah,
I mean, the records just sound totally different.
Yeah.
What do you think about where the music's gone?
Definitely changed a lot. It's definitely changed a lot. I think the more popular side of it has become the accepted form of it, which is generally the harder, more dance floor side of it. And there's a much, much more different musical sides to it and different styles of dubstep. But they're nowhere near as popular. And a lot of people just accept dubstep as the super hard tear out, you know.
Unfortunately, that's kind
heavy
of like
metal type stuff. You know, that's what a lot of the general public sort of.
When you say dubstep, oh god, it's,
right?
Oh god, it's so noisy, and you're like, yeah, because of what you've heard, probably. I get
sure.
And when you think of dubstep, if you don't know dubstep, the first thing you're gonna mention is probably someone like Skrillex or whatever.
Yeah.
Jeez, come here. Let me take you. Come listen to this. This is dubstep. Oh no, I like this stuff. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is like kind of where it started. Oh right. Oh no, I like this stuff. So it's kind of like that, you know what I'm saying? I think.
So how much of that is good for the culture, and how much of it is hurts the culture?
It's all good.
Yeah.
It's all good. The fact that dubstep, you can't take away of what it is and what it's done. It is a global virus that took over the world. Like, there's been no music, in my opinion, that has done what dubstep has done.
I agree.
Every single country in the world embraced it.
Yeah.
That's nuts. And it all come from London.
Yeah.
London. Like, you can fit England and California four times.
Mm-hmm.
London.
True. Yeah.
Like, that's nuts.
Right.
That's crazy.
So when you hear, I think it's Britney Spears as a new track that's, what was it called?
Hold It Against Me.
Okay. That's like got a dubstep track. I don't know if you guys have heard of that.
Yeah.
How does that feel when you see stuff like that?
I think Taylor Swift does too.
Okay.
I think a lot of people as well, like, when they hear a halftime pattern, they're like, oh, that's dubstep. It's like, well, it's just halftime pattern.
Right.
I've just slowed it down a little bit and put a couple reverb snares in it.
It's just a half track that kind of goes to half time.
Rhythm, yeah.
You know,
I mean, you definitely hear...
By that definition, you could call, like, 90s Boys to Men slow jams dubstep. You know, they have the same drum pattern.
Got the big snares, you know what I mean?
That's it, you know. Yeah. So it's just not really dubstep.
Okay.
And I think, you know, when something's popular, it's popular.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So people want to embrace it and take a little bit of that and go, that's popular. Oh, that's cool. Let me see if I can add a little bit of that on here, because if I do, then this might be popular.
Yeah.
If French horns were popular, it would have a French horn solo on it.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, look
it's
at
just a grab.
Look at Trap,
yeah.
For instance, a typical example. When it blew up, Trap is really, like, it's not nothing new.
Mm-hmm.
It's just been kind of made into more of a dance style patterned layout of the music.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? But now you hear every advert or on TV that's selling mayonnaise or selling something else. It's got like a, hey, like a trap beat behind it. Why? Because 808s. Because why? Because that's what's popular.
Yeah.
So they want to try and take a little bit of it. And that happened to dubstep. It happens to every music.
Mm-hmm.
When it gets house now as well, like house is popular, so everyone's doing the house beats. And, you know, trends come and go.
So how much of that evolution has influenced the music that you guys are making now?
I mean, when we're talking about UK evolution, because when you listen back to the old stuff, like you said, it has a particular sound and style. It's nothing like now.
Right.
How we make music and how we've gone back to making music is like, what are our influences? And it is straight up UK music.
Mm-hmm.
It's jungle, it's reggae, it's dub.
Jungle and garage.
And garage.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we grew up on. Mm-hmm. And that's why we made the stuff we made then. So we're kind of like, well, let's go back to those influences and do it with all the new production and ideas that we've kind of learned over the last 7 years and kind of...
I tell our sort of dubstep minds and fingers having a go at doing jungle and garage and all those type of sounds, and you know, it kind of comes out sounding really like Back to Basics.
Yeah.
But we definitely consciously avoided doing anything, you know, like big 808 drums and rolling hi-hats and all, you know.
Yeah.
We've definitely avoided any obvious places.
Mm.
And by doing so, it kept. And also, we dug out all the old folders of sounds, like down to drum hits and cool. synth presets and stuff. So it's all obviously new tracks, but even down to the individual elements, like the snare drums and stuff, we dug out all the old fold, like 10-year-old folders. So we've been using sort of new programs to sort of arrange old materials.
Yeah. Like it will sound a bit fatter and
everything. Yeah, so it's kind of like, yeah, like revamped and fatter, but...
Cool.
It definitely, you know, you could definitely listen to 10 of the old tracks next to 10 of the new tracks and it would sound consistent.
Nice.
100%.
Yeah.
But yeah, as far as the evolution goes of it, I mean, we've gone full circle with it, really.
Yeah.
Mm. I feel like it took a, you know, it got so big and so commercial, and then that kind of burst a little bit, and then it's still going, it's still very much popular, very much moving through and very strong. But the commercial side of it, for me, the fact that it, you know, it come down a bit, it was great.
Mm-hmm.
It gives it a bit of breathing space, because at one point it was like every page at dubstep, so no wonder why people got sick of the word, do you know what I'm saying, dubstep, because it was everywhere. So let's give someone else a go. Leave us alone for a sec.
Sure.
Let us just kind of, and then once you do that, then everyone goes, "Oh, that's not popular. Oh, I'm gonna go and do this." Great, you go.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like it's been filtered.
Like a filter, yeah.
You know what I mean? Right. You know, when you filter water and all the crap gets stuck in the filter, and then you throw the filter. Yeah, we're back to the goodness, which is
that's why
the water
we both
you
took
drink.
Time mm-hmm. off the road to have the studio time. You know,
yeah.
Now is a good time to sort of get back in and sort of get creative and use that, you know.
Yeah.
There's a gap now,
yeah,
and we're ready to plug it.
Like there was when we started.
There was a gap then.
And we took it.
And we took it. And there's a gap again now. It's been long enough.
Yeah.
Definitely.
So you mentioned your experience playing basketball.
Mm.
What did you learn from playing basketball that you apply to your music?
Commitment. Blood, sweat and tears.
Mm.
Do whatever it takes to get what you need. Within reason.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? If you want, I mean, I'm 5'8". So when I say play basketball, they're like, "Oh, you're a bit small, you know." Especially in the UK, they're like, "Oh, basketball, when you've got to be like 7 foot tall."
Yeah.
It's like, no, it's point guards. Muggsy Bogues is 5'3".
Uh-huh.
So, like, it's just commitment and hard work. If you want to get somewhere, you've got to work hard at it, and you've got to be persistent, and you've got to eat, breathe, and shit.
So talk about how that's played out in your music career.
I suppose that's what I've done. I've just translated my energy from basketball into music and kind of done the same thing. I've nurtured a label and brought artists through on it and kind of done that. I mean, I think it's been the main reason why it's got me where I've got.
Mm.
It's because I've just taken what I've done in that and just moved it over to something else. I guess. I don't know. You know?
No, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I think that's just what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
When I love something, I just go. That's it. It's like, you know, full steam ahead on it, mm-hmm. and I'll do everything for it. And
hard work can still be really enjoyable.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That's the lesson that I've learned.
Yeah.
Know? Yeah.
So when have you guys seen that commitment tested? Right. You're gonna hit. You're gonna have high and low points.
Yeah.
So can you give us a point where you had to really summon that commitment to push through?
I mean, usually touring, I think. You know, 50 odd date tours where you're away for 2 or 3 months. That's where really it could be. And you just can't work on any music either.
Mm-hmm.
That for me is what drives me crazy. Not the exhaustion or the jet lag or anything else. It's the not being able to be creative for like 2 months.
Yeah,
that's definitely been the. That's always the hardest point.
Mm.
No matter how good the shows at the end of the tour are, sometimes it can be brutally hard. But yeah, I've been on tour. I've gone on a 2 month tour, a married man, and come back divorced with all the locks changed.
Wow,
that was kind of hard.
Yeah, I would imagine.
That was quite testing.
Mm.
Yeah, that's my jolly happy answer.
That's a good one.
Yeah.
Well, you know, so you guys don't love the road. I get that.
No, we do.
No. Do.
Okay.
Definitely do.
But it will swallow you up.
Yeah.
Is what it is. It's like you've got to be careful because if you're doing, like you said, 50 dates all over like 2 months, and every night there's things around you that can, you know what I'm saying, make it a little bit more difficult. You've got to be aware of, like, at some point to be like, geez, you know? Because it can. It's just, it's easy, isn't it, to kind of just get involved and just have that as standard.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
From a business standpoint, that seems like the right way to go, right? To make these tours long.
Yeah.
Get as much money as possible. So, like, not going in that direction, are you guys sacrificing some pieces of business for creative freedom?
Somewhat, yeah.
Most definitely.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
But that's the fun. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, going and doing tours, easy. Doesn't make it. You don't wake up with a knot in your stomach thinking,
mm-hmm.
I've got to make this happen.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. I want to, for me personally, not speaking for Chris, but I want to make it happen with the music. Because I know that once people hear the music, we'll be able to do what we want.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah, so one of the things we've heard from DJs is that, you know, taking a tune out to a crowd and playing it live in front of them or real time in front of them and seeing the energy, right, that's really helped them, you know, learning to read a room.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's helped guide how they approach making music. Is that, I don't know if that's true for everybody. Is that valuable for you? Is that necessary?
I think it's bullshit.
Okay.
To be honest.
Yeah.
If I'm blunt.
Yeah.
Because what does that matter? You go and play a tune and people are like, yeah, woo. Like, great, you're like, oh, everyone loves this.
When you release,
keep making more.
When you release a new track, a new single, the percentage of people that are going to be hearing it at your gig compared to hearing it on their headphones or on their home speakers is minuscule, really.
Yeah.
You can't judge one room's reaction in the middle of a club night because just 95% of the people are going to be listening to that track on their laptop or on their iPod.
Yeah. Or they're just absorbed into the night and they're like, you could be playing any tune right now.
Mm-hmm.
You're still going to go off to it.
That's it, yeah.
And that's when it starts getting generic and you start making the same stuff. When you start making music for reactions, you're done.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I'd rather make a tune that people stand there and go.
But everyone falls in that trap, though. You fall in that trap as well, though, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. We all fall in the trap.
You know what I mean? Yeah. You're away, then home for a couple of days, then got a few more shows, then home for a couple of days.
I've
you end up just making dance floor bangers with big build-ups and heavy drops.
Yeah.
And you can't, it gets boring.
Everyone's, everyone. We've both been victim of that, and realizing though, and changing that, I think, like I said, making people not, and kind of having to think about it, for me, is perfect. I'd rather you tell me you don't like it, because that's great for me. It's because you don't get it yet. Which means I'm doing some futuristic shit. So when it comes round, you're going to be like,
"That's terrible."
I do get it. And that's what Dubstep was, though. People didn't get it, did they? They were like,
"That's true."
It just sounds like pots and pans, like really slow, though. It sounds like you're just stoned. You're like, "Yeah, maybe." And suddenly it's like the biggest thing in the world.
Slow down pots and pans.
What do you think was the tipping point?
In what?
In like people didn't get Dubstep, and then they did, and it became so mainstream. Like, what helped break? What helped? The breakthrough,
the acceptance of media, radio play, all the kind of other crap, do you know what I mean, that people may might go
I think
to
our looks as well, like, like our looks, how we physically look,
definitely. No doubt
they needed a couple of handsome faces to front the Dubstep campaign.
For sure.
I think that was definitely a big part. Sorry.
Well, so think about that though. You know, Fabric Live was kind of a breaking point for
it
you
was
guys,
yeah
right?
Yeah.
And so how big was that? And give us, like, you know, take us kind of back to that moment when it was blowing up, and what did that feel like?
Oh, wow. Well, the crazy thing about that CD is it was, for a lot of countries around the world, it was the only dubstep CD you could go and buy in a, you know, in a normal kind of CD shop store where you'd buy Britney Spears or whatever. So tons and tons of countries, that was like the only CD that you could buy. So that was like the only dubstep CD kids had in their cars when they were going to school and stuff like that. For there was a couple of years where that was the case in so many places that was like such a huge thing for us. It was such a major boost, because we would, you know, the other dubstep cats would be, you know, playing in Germany and places, and we'd be going to like Ukraine and going to all these other crazy places because that Fabric, you know, whoever does all their CDs has good distribution all around the world. You know, it's like well respected, and you can get those CDs everywhere. So
I suppose people heard of it.
That was that was huge.
But maybe it wasn't accessible to them straight away. But with the Fabric thing, it was everywhere. So it was kind of people's first introduction to like, oh, I can go and buy this CD from the shop and put it on. Oh, what's this? Oh my God, this is it. This is dubstep. And that's what it got. That was people's kind of like Bible as it was, you know, saying, to dubstep.
So how does that change the game for you guys?
Well, we didn't, I think we knew what we was doing was wicked and it was important for us and great, and we'd get some shows out of it and it'd be cool. We knew that. We didn't know what was about to happen.
That's true. Yeah,
like, we wasn't ready for it.
Yeah,
do you know what I'm saying?
Was there a moment where you guys looked at each other and you're like, fuck, this is really
Exit Festival. Yeah, we played after right after Lily Allen on the main stage.
No, it was Lily Allen, Arctic Monkeys, and then Casper Uskoe.
That's it. Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And it was like 30,000 people.
Yeah.
And this is 2009. This is like a year after the CD.
Yeah.
Like, what? Yeah, what's happening here?
Yeah, that was crazy.
And people were singing the tunes.
Yeah.
Right.
Like Jehovah.
Yeah. That
people
was it,
were
yeah.
singing
yeah.
the hook of Jehovah, and I'm like, he made this in his bedroom in Acton.
Is it? Yeah.
What are you not singing it for? This is Serbia. How do you not know about this?
Yeah,
that's what we knew. It was like,
in Serbia, and you couldn't see the back of the crowd. You couldn't see where the end of the crowd. There's so many people singing along to that. Yeah, right.
That's what we knew.
So when you guys went your separate ways, were you guys worried about like how to keep the fan base together?
Not really. No, it was the same. It was the same fan base. You know, there was unless it so happened that we were playing in the same city on the same night, which I don't think ever happened. That would be the only time it would really be an issue. I don't think we have the same audience. I think it's in a way they get twice as much music.
Yeah,
you know, they get like a new Casper album every couple of years and a new Rusko album every couple of years. They get a, you know, Casper show every time he tours and a Rusko show every time I tour. So
yeah,
essentially, if you're a fan of the music and what we do, I suppose us doing our separate thing, you kind of got twice as much shows and music wise.
Yeah.
In a way.
And that was the question for years that we'd, funny because I remember texting and we were saying, oh, geez, if we had like a cent for every time someone said, when are you going to come back here with Roscoe? I was like, we wouldn't have to DJ.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. It was like that was the question.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh, I love what you do.
Oh, that's been the most asked question.
When you playing with Roscoe, I was like,
yes.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Maybe never. It got to a point where I was like, never.
Oh, I've never said never.
No, I just said never because it was like constantly asked me never. And I was like, I don't think it's never going to happen.
Right.
It's been this long. It might not.
Yeah, that's it. I'm always like, I
just be willing to accept that maybe. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
Never say never.
That's how it was. But yeah, individually, we would roll through the city sometimes. Roscoe would be one week, I'd be there the other.
Yeah, mm-hmm. So that's it.
And we was on the circuit at the same time, so that made it a lot easier.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that's happened, you know, I think it's always been this way more so in the UK, but in the US, brands have really gotten involved in dance music, right? Yeah. You know, 7-Up's got a big campaign, you know, Scion, Red Bull. You know, how does that change things? Do you think it does?
In what way do you mean?
I don't know. Well, like when you guys think about, you know, working with a brand or brands just being involved in the festivals or in the culture in general, do you think that that has an impact on
your brand?
Hmm.
I mean, I personally, it's here nor there for me.
Okay. Mm.
If the event's sponsored by blah, 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 and they're giving out free blah, blah, blah,
yeah,
good for them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
I ain't going to stand on stage with a can of blah, blah, blah and be like,
Yeah,
that's not what we do.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd rather not do that. If it feels right and natural,
mm-hmm.
I feel like, for me anyway, I feel like,
yeah,
cool. If it fits in what we do, we'd do something. But I think you can get so caught up in that.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I'm saying? And brands can get so caught up in that idea. And I don't know. I just feel like people can see through stuff very easily.
Yeah.
So you've got to be careful with it. I mean, we done the Zion. Back in the day, we done a Zion CD with them when it was... I think we done the first dubstep thing with them.
Mm-hmm.
That was that 2009.
Yeah.
Then we done a tour of it.
Yeah.
They understood what we were trying to do, and it worked.
Yeah.
Maybe it won't work now, but at the time it just did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I
think. What do you think worked about it?
They just was willing to understand how we want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when brands come in and they want to kind of do stuff with you, they have a vision of how they want to do it, which is cool. But I think
they have no experience doing what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like it's a point where you need to work really with the brand to go, well, trust us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if we do it more this way, it's going to be a little bit more natural. Do you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But as far as brands and that go, I mean, it's in America more so. It's way more present.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was just going to ask you. Yeah. The way more present. 100%.
Yeah.
And artists.
I don't
even notice though, really, usually.
Yeah. No.
You know, you see it on most flyers, really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Sponsored by this, that, and these things happening. But I don't even notice.
Yeah, really, I don't think anyone really cares.
No. Sort of glides past. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the Zion thing worked. It just worked, and it was right. And they were just like, whatever you want to do,
mm-hmm.
cool. We want to put out a CD. Cool, that's fine. Download for free. Cool, fine. Whatever. We want to do small club shows. Cool, we want it to be free to get in. Cool, no problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, what? You guys are cool. You're a Toyota. We thought you were going to be more, no, you have to do this, do that. Oh, no, this is going to work out.
Yeah.
And we done it because it was right for the music and it translated. I think people are not stupid. That's the way I see it. If you're trying to flog them something and they're just going to be like, what? You don't need to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's like a fine line.
Well, that's cool to hear you say. So we started that program for Scion when it was all the hip-hop stuff.
Mm.
And it was exactly what you said, right? It's like, let the artists do what they want to do.
Yeah.
Give something to the people, free shows,
yeah.
you know, whatever, that they're not getting otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's, you know, a lot of brands miss that.
And it made so much sense.
Yeah.
Why spend so much money on a TV advert that's probably not going to hit anywhere near your target audience?
Right.
Mm.
Just send out some people that your target audience love and let them do what they do and just back it.
Mm-hmm.
That's but essentially what they've done.
Right.
Love it.
And they did Scion socks, which were really comfortable.
Yeah, the socks were
amazing. They were amazing socks.
Yeah.
Side note. Do you still have some?
Yeah, somewhere.
They were so good.
Somewhere around.
So good.
What you guys maybe don't know is
We, our full-time jobs is running a marketing agency doing really cool pop-up experiences and social. So a little bit of
Well, I think, do you know what, as well? In the right circumstance, it works.
Mm-hmm.
Branding.
Yeah.
But I feel like it's more like commercially it works better.
Yeah.
I feel like where it doesn't work with the underground so much is they just clash too much.
Sure. Right.
Brands don't get it and artists don't want to do it.
Do you think they don't want to do it because the audience just doesn't, they don't want to see you in that position?
People see, I mean, I've signed up to do stuff before. I won't say with who.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a bit dubious about it and I'd done it and I was like, I knew that it was going to be like this. I wish I just left it.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? It's just, it translates, and I think people are like, they actually come up to you, you don't have to do this, you know? Like, we'll we'll come to the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. Why am I doing it then?
Business reasons.
Yeah.
Well, it's, you know, someone's putting a check in your face, right? Yeah. Sometimes that's hard to walk away from.
Definitely, but, you know, if you took every check that was put in your face, where would you be?
Yeah.
At some point, you got to just go, thank you, but I'm all right.
So let's follow that a little bit. What would feel like selling out to you, and how do you navigate that?
I think if we booked a load of reunion gigs as Casper Rusko without making any new music together, and just sort of showed up to do a reunion, just relying on playing all our old tunes.
Sure.
And then going home and calling it a day, that would definitely feel like selling out. But I say, with the whole album's worth of travel, I mean, we've been spending a day in a rehearsal space every week with decks set up in like a band rehearsal room, like going through the set over and over, like getting it all tightened up and stuff. You know, we've been putting a show together. It's the total opposite of that. But I think if we were just kind of showing up, getting back together, and just kind of relying on the old tracks that everyone loves and mixing them together and then going home and getting the money, that would feel crappy, and people would see through that.
Yeah, I think
sell that out, would feel like selling out for sure.
Sellouts are like a loose word, isn't it, as well?
Yeah.
I suppose, because what is selling out really? Like, what does it mean? You're selling out for what? For the money? The fame?
Essentially, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I suppose, like, geez, then we've all sold out a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
At what point do you go, I want to do it for the underground? And at what point do you go, I actually just want to do this?
Yeah.
Do you know what I'm saying? And the way I see it is, if you can put your hand up and go, yeah, that's me, in a crowd room, or, yeah, I've done that, then it's not selling out.
Absolutely.
If you do this, who done that? That's selling out.
Right.
Because you're not comfortable doing it.
Yeah.
As long as you're comfortable doing it, for me, it's here nor there. Because people are just going to say it anyway. When we done the Fabric CD, oh, you sold out dubstep. Why? Because if we weren't going to do it, someone else was going to do it, and it's probably going to be worse.
Yeah.
Much worse. So we've just done what we've done. Mm-hmm. Took an opportunity. We thought it was right, and look where we are.
Yeah.
So for me, that's what it means to me.
Yeah, I like that. Sticking with the business theme for a minute, what about merch? How important is that for you guys?
I mean, right now, we're doing one show, so not necessarily like that important.
Yeah.
Maybe later on down the line.
Is it still all about selling merch at a show, or how big is you know, the internet and social media for you guys?
Shows is still more. Yeah. Shows is still a much higher percentage than online and Facebook and stuff. Definitely, I would say with merch. But no, we're giving away like stickers and lighters and stuff for free at the show, right?
Yeah.
But. Yeah, that's as far as it's going so far, freebies.
I think, again, merch is important, but also I think you have to be really realistic with it. People come into your show and they're spending $20.
Yeah.
All right, they've probably got a cab there, or someone's given a lift, they've chipped in for petrol, that's another $10. They're going to come in, they're going to buy a few drinks, that's $60.
Mm.
You're selling merchandise and you're selling overpriced crap T-shirts, and that's they haven't got $100.
Mm-hmm.
Let's keep the ticket price reasonable.
Yeah.
Let's try and do it places where we can that's going to be reasonable, like for drinks. Let's try and keep merchandise reasonable. Because if you can't afford it, what's the point of having it? It's no point sitting in the loft or in the basement, just there.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather someone walk around with it and going, yeah, I'm proud of this. So for me, it's like merch is important. Mm-hmm. But I also feel like you can get so caught up in doing everything and anything in merch
right.
and charging a fortune for it. It's actually, I don't think it's actually translating the way you want it to.
Yeah.
So I think it's a fine thing. Less is more. And think of it from a punter's point of view. You don't want to spend $40 on a Fruit of the Loom thin see-through t-shirt that shrinks in the wash.
Right.
You, if you're going to spend that money, you want a half-decent t-shirt.
Yeah.
So I think, if you, again, if you do it, do it properly and do it reasonable. Because we, you know, we was all in that situation once going to a show.
True.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's important. I mean, I know for bands, that's like their bread and butter on the road, because they don't make no money. So the merch is what they split and make money.
Right.
But I think in what we do, it's important, but it, I think it's just a little cherry on top.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So who's who are you guys checking for now? DJs, producers, like what's exciting you?
Like UK grime at the moment.
Yeah.
Mm. The revival of the UK grime, because I used to play and collect all the old stuff. So just going through the old hard drive of having all the stuff, and that's really exciting.
I mean, Skepta and Jamie.
Yeah.
Definitely, both of those guys.
One line flows, yeah, I got some of those. You get me, Jamie? Easy. Nah, that's not me. Act like a waste man, that's not me. Sex any girl, nah, that's not me. Lips any girl, nah, that's not me. Yeah, I used to wear Gucci, I put it all in the bin, cause that's not me. True, I used to look like you, but dressing like a mess, nah, that's not me. It's the return of the Mac, I'm still alive just like Tupac.
There's a bunch of new guys. I mean, that in general was kind of influencing both of us, I suppose, isn't it?
Yeah, big time.
When we were writing tunes.
Yeah, big time.
I think we're keeping it very traditional, very at home, very in London.
Mm-hmm.
We're going back to our local influences. We're not trying to look too far afield.
There's some jungle cats called Sterling Sound.
Okay.
And K-Jar as well. They're like making new school jungle that's like sounds proper old school, but really crispy and nice and heavy fat sounding.
Yeah.
So yeah, I've been mixing a lot of that in my little at home practice sessions on the ones and twos.
Nice.
Yeah, that's yeah.
Yeah, I think outside of that, it's like, me personally, I'm not really kind of, I never have though really, is looked too hard.
Mm-hmm.
I listen to a lot of hip hop. I always have, but that's really
new hip hop.
I mean, it's hard. Hip hop is such a loose term now. You say hip hop, and then you go, oh, look, Rick Ross, that's not hip hop.
Right.
Do you know what I'm saying? Like,
sure.
I suppose if the umbrella's hip hop, I listen to everything.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? New stuff, old stuff.
What do you like that's new?
What was I listening to the other day? There's a few like Young Chop beats I was listening to. I like the kind of new trap style hip hop because it reminds me of really early dubstep.
Sure.
Stripped back, bassy, gritty, not very well produced.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And that's what I love about it.
It's that's like, what I love about grime.
Yeah, and yeah, grime's exactly the same. Yeah. And that's why kind of there's a fusion right now in the UK of kind of like trap influence from the States and the UK grime. Mm. And that's really merging.
That's what we have to do when we've been making some of the Casper Roscoe tracks that have been more grime influenced. That's one of the things we've been actually consciously been having to be like, you know, don't put too much effects on it. Don't, you know, like to keeping it rough. Because it's part of the sound, yeah. Certain genres, part of the sound is that it's underproduced
it's
almost.
The crappiness of it.
Yeah, that's it, yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
It's part of the sound.
So I suppose that really.
It's hard sometimes when you've got all the everything in front of you and you're used to doing things by the book to intentionally underproduce a track. But sometimes that's the only way you can get that classic sort of jungle or grime sound.
It's like the old stuff. You listen back to old mixes, you're like,
exactly.
That is crap.
Mm-hmm.
It works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like when to say stop.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's one of the things that's so interesting about music, right, is that, you know, good music on paper is not, that's not what it's about, right? It's about how it makes you feel inside, and that could be anything. It could be somebody singing off key. It could be somebody that completely fucked up the production.
A lot of my early tunes are completely out of key.
Yeah,
I didn't even know at the time. I just thought it sounded great.
Yeah,
but they just worked.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like that was the rawness of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. People were like, oh okay.
So it seems like you guys have. You've kind of made careers just jumping in and figuring shit out as you go.
Yeah.
Have there been mentors that have helped you? And what's the most important thing that somebody taught you?
I think
each other, I suppose, yeah. in a way.
Yeah.
It's just been a learning curve, because when we got thrown into it, we didn't have anyone to go, what do we do here?
Mm.
We were asking ourselves, what do we do here?
No one that had done it before.
No one done it before in our scene. Mm-hmm. So we were just kind of making mistakes, and we'll try not to make mistakes along the way and do it.
Right. It was later on that we became friendly with, you know, drum and bass guys, you know, that have done this whole thing before.
Yeah,
sure. But back in the day, we didn't really have any... We weren't really, you know, tight with people like that.
Yeah.
Yeah, just to always pick up sayings, and one I picked up was, don't try being current, just be consistent.
Mm.
Mm.
And I thought that was good. Very relevant, you know what I mean, to what we're doing. And another one was like, if you're going to fail doing what you love.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Cliche, but very true at the same time. And I think along the way, we was learning all the time, and... I'm still learning, and we're still learning. But I think the difference is now, is because we've done this for a little while now.
Yeah.
I suppose we can look back and go, yeah, I'm not going to do that again. Right. I'm not going to do that again.
That's true. No,
I know where this is going. I've seen this all before. I'm all right, thanks.
That's why it's exciting.
Yeah.
Because we can kind of, you know, I mean, the plans that we're planning, and, you know, everything that we've got going ahead, Casper Roscoe-wise, we're planning with the knowledge of everything we've just done and sort of making it just all about the fun.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
You know, like we're here all week, we're chilling, you know, we're not flying in for the show doing a rushed one day of press, you know, we're doing this and we're going for lunch and just, you know, it's we're just making it all about fun, really trying to enjoy it as much as possible.
Well, a couple final questions, and we have a couple Twitter questions. Our Twitter's blowing up with you guys.
Cool.
Well, let's see, one of them you already answered. This is from Tory Banks 88.
Hey, Tory.
Let's see, you already answered how big of an impact the Fabric Live mix had on the fan base, but her follow-up to that is, have you thought about another recording for Fabric Live?
We haven't actually spoke about it.
We haven't. We've never ever said we should do another Fabric CD.
That's true.
It was what it was, in my opinion.
Okay.
It's and it been is more it about is. But whole albums worth of collaboration tunes, really. That's more what's planned.
Yeah.
More it's, satisfying for us,
I think.
Easy,
I think it's easy to go, that worked, let's try it again.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't... Yeah, no. Fabric Live is what it is. Yeah, exactly. No, definitely not. It's like, no.
That was what
it's
it was.
It's like Home Alone 2 or something. Oh, no, that was actually all right.
Home Alone 3.
Oh, yeah.
They tried to push it, and it was
well,
like,
if you change your mind, then Tory Banks 88 gets a free ticket to the release party.
No, we're just planning Fabric whole full length LPs of original tracks.
Yeah,
that's definitely what to expect.
Mm. Nice.
Mm.
And my last question is what's the best business decision you guys have made?
Oh, jeez.
For me, it was moving to Los Angeles.
Mm.
Because I do a lot of writing and other stuff on the side, music-wise. So, and of course, being over here when dubstep exploded in the US. So, for me, it was moving to the States.
Yeah.
I think saving the money for the tax man.
Yeah.
Because you know what? No, it's to be truthful,
the
right?
A big one.
When we started earning decent money, there was no one to sort of say, don't do this, don't do that.
True,
I'll put this in your bank, and because you're going to have just roll along. You know, you see like NBA stars, and suddenly they're broke, and you're like, you signed like a $16 million contract.
Because
they had no one give them financial advice.
Like
we didn't know how big it was going to be, and we were just kind of rolling along. I suppose in my mind, I always put a little bit away for the rainy day, and it happened. The tax man knocked on my door and took everything, but I had it.
Yeah.
So I suppose for me, if I didn't have that, I wouldn't have been... able to do anything now.
You're not the first one to say that.
No, that's so great.
DJ, you know,
I wish I had someone straight away going, look, just be a little bit with this and with that. But like I said, we were just learning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I suppose for me, that's been enabled me to do this still.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm thankful that I did put it away for a rainy day.
No, that's great. We had a story from Richard Vision, who's a big LA house DJ. He said, his first big publishing check, he was driving around a piece of shit, beat up car, and he was on his way to the dealer, you know, with the check, and his business manager said, you're not going to go buy a car, you're going to go buy a house. And he went and bought a, you know, reasonable house, but you know, he was 22 years old. He had no interest in a house, but she made him do it. And you know, he said that's been one of the best decisions he's made, because he still has the house and he's been able to weather the ups and downs.
Mm-hmm. That's the thing, isn't it? Yeah. It's probably kept him in check to be able to go, I don't have to go and get a real job to pay that rent every month. I can kind of just survive
on a couple gigs. Yeah, you just do what you love.
Yeah.
I have one last question. Oh, being an artist is definitely not an easy road. You know, sometimes it could take years, even decades, to blow up and really become popular and have a fan base. What have you guys sacrificed to get to this point?
Several relationships. a marriage, several relationships. A couple of bones.
A couple of ribs.
A lot of brain cells.
I think from my side, the biggest thing was being able not to do, for years, birthdays, weddings, get-togethers.
Yeah.
Like, because there's a whole side of DJing that's not talked about, which is, for me, is very dark. And but there's a whole nother ballgame of it. And the realism, you go on tour for 6 weeks and you don't speak to anyone, you hardly speak to anyone. Then you come back and you hit people up, for instance, and you're like, it's a Monday. Oh, do you want to go out and grab a drink? Oh, I can't, I've got work tomorrow.
Right.
Mm. Okay. What about Saturday? Oh, I can't Saturday, I'm in Belgium. Sunday, I'm in Holland.
Right.
What about Monday? And I'm back at work. So you're just constantly by yourself.
Yeah.
You tour and you go to a hotel room, you sit in a hotel room, you go to the show, you come back, you get on a plane by yourself, you come back, you're at the flat by yourself, all your mates are at work.
Mm.
Like, it's lonely.
Yeah.
So I think being able to cope with yourself, being an artist, because there's a lot of time you're just in your zone and you're by yourself doing what you do. Being able to cope with everything else and not being there for people and go, don't worry, I've got a plan. I've got a plan. Because in 3 years' time, I'm going to take this much time off and we can do all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
It's been able to see past that.
I totally admire that. I mean, I try to spend time alone and in my creative zone, and I can't do it without like having or feeling guilty not seeing my friends or family.
Yeah. You've got to give that sacrifice. Yeah. I mean, everything's a sacrifice.
Nice. Okay. Well, guys, thanks for being here. Yeah. I appreciate you coming on Rebel Radio. Cool, come back anytime. You're here to promote something. You're always welcome.
Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks,
nice.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right, that's it. Let us know what you thought. Hit us up on Twitter at Rebel Radio Net. Hit us on Facebook with a comment. Leave us a review on iTunes. Tell a friend. Come back next week for more Rebel Radio.